This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll take a look at the role that NATO has played in Russia's war in Ukraine.
And with our guest, Richard Becker, explore the responsibility of the United States itself for the war in Ukraine.
We'll also take a look at one of the most pervasive forms of censorship in the United States.
That would be book banning, and it's on the rise at high school and college campuses, according to our guest, Chris Finan.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild. And now as we turn our attention to the matter of Russia's war in Ukraine, let me introduce this topic by briefly sharing a few of my own thoughts on the matter. I certainly do not support the Russian invasion and its ongoing military assault in Ukraine, and I believe Putin should find a way to end his war before peace and stability worldwide is even more deeply diminished than it already has been, before the destruction of Ukraine and the deaths of the people accelerate even further, before the devastating sanctions imposed on Russia end up causing a great harm not only to the Russian people, but to working-class people all around the globe. I also believe that the United States bears at least as much blame for the war as does Russia. That may at first seem an odd thing to believe, but if you stay tuned, today's guest on this topic will explain why he and I believe this to be true. I believe that if a way to end the bloodshed is not found, and found soon, no one can be sure the current war will not spread far beyond the current conflict, thereby radically changing the future in ways, well, ways too dire to contemplate. Lastly, I am personally saddened beyond adequate description, over the fact of this new war. It reminds me that, like America's illegal and devastating wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere, that since the days of the caveman wielding his handmade club, although the weapons used by warring sides to resolve their differences have advanced and become far more deadly and sophisticated, we humans have not advanced enough to have found the way to resolve our disputes beyond that of the caveman wielding his handheld club. Well, let me now introduce today's guest. He is Richard Becker. Mr. Becker is the Western Regional Coordinator of the ANSWER Coalition, that is, the Act Now to Stop War and End Racism Coalition. Richard Becker is a regular contributor to the Liberation newspaper, a publication of the Party for Socialism and Liberation, of which he is a member. And Mr. Becker is the author of Palestine, Israel, and the U.S. Empire, as well as of the book The Myth of Democracy and the Rule of the Banks. Richard Becker, a warm welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks a lot. Great to be here.
All right, Richard, I wonder if you might explain why you believe, as do I really, that the U.S. is as, or perhaps more responsible for Russia's war in Ukraine, as is Russia, or as your organization, the Party for Socialism and Liberation, puts it, and I quote, "The current crisis is a byproduct of a long effort by the United States to establish absolute domination throughout Europe. The U.S. policy is aimed at undermining Russia's security by surrounding it with advanced missiles that can reach their Russian targets in less than 10 minutes," close quote. So briefly explain, really, what the U.S. and NATO did after the fall of the former Soviet Union that leads you to claim the U.S. bears a major responsibility for the current war in Ukraine. And could this war have been avoided, and what prevented a negotiated settlement of the conflict?
Well, yeah, you know, if anyone looks at a map, and you can find these maps pretty easily online, you just look at NATO expansion maps, Google that, and you will be able to see that over the last 25 years, since 1997, when they started the expansion of NATO under the Bill Clinton administration, NATO has gone from 16 countries, member countries, to 30 member countries. And virtually every single one of the additional 14, the 14 that have been added on, are from the former Soviet Union. They were part of the former Soviet Union, like the Baltic states, or they were Eastern European countries that were allied with the Soviet with the Soviet Union when it existed. And so the clear intent is to surround European Russia with NATO military power. And when we talk about NATO, we know that NATO has always been led by the United States. It pretended to be a defensive alliance. It was always an offensive alliance from the time it was formed in 1949. The Warsaw Pact of the Eastern European countries and the Soviet Union didn't come into being until 1955, so 6 years later, and then it went out of existence in 1990 with the fall of those governments, and then 1991, the fall of the Soviet Union and its dissolution. But NATO has continued. NATO has not only continued, NATO has expanded. And the clear intent of that expansion, as I said, is to surround Russia with NATO power, including nuclear weapons that a number of the NATO states possess, and to be able to station them in areas that are very close to the heartland of Russia, its western heartland anyways, where its major cities are and much of its economy. And that intention was really furthered back in 2014 when the U.S. played a very active role in the overthrow of the Ukrainian government, which was a kind of neutral government, with the intention of bringing Ukraine into NATO and the European Union and NATO at that time. And that was prevented, but the same group of people who were in charge of U.S. policy back in 2014 when there was the overthrow of the government and participated very much in it, people like Victoria Nuland and even the Vice President of the United States, whose portfolio was Ukraine back then, his name was Biden, and Joseph Biden is back, and Victoria Nuland is back here in 2022. And other members of that foreign policy team, and they moved again, I think, to try to do this. And if, just to finish by saying, if they had succeeded in bringing Ukraine into the European Union, and particularly into NATO, it would have meant a 1,200-mile border between Russia and Ukraine, Western Russia and Eastern Ukraine. And if it was part of NATO, it could be also a staging ground for missiles, including nuclear tip missiles, that could hit key cities of Russia in a matter of moments, a matter of a few minutes at a time. So I think that constant, this kind of relentless push to finish off the surrounding by bringing Ukraine into NATO really, really is... bears the primary responsibility for the crisis that we now see.
Mary Elise Cerotti, a history professor at Johns Hopkins, whose field is the Cold War, wrote a few days ago in the New York Times that the world now faces a future where, and I quote, "The years between the Cold War and the COVID-19 pandemic will seem a halcyon period to future historians compared to what came after. I fear we may find ourselves missing the old Cold War," end quote. Well, I suspect none of us would actually miss that old Cold War. Does she have a point when she argues that the future looks far, far worse?
The future looks dangerous. I think I would agree on that. The future looks quite dangerous. But at the same time, of course, we would have to say that that's not how that halcyon, if that's the right word, pronunciation, period applied to if you lived in Libya or you lived in Iraq or you lived in Palestine. So I think we've seen a kind of a continuation of a kind of Eurocentric point of view in talking about that. But I do think that it's true that the danger of a wider war and perhaps a truly catastrophic war on a more global basis has greatly increased because of the recent developments.
And following up on Heidi's question, and I'm glad you mentioned what you did about Iraq and Afghanistan and what happened in the Middle East, because I think ethnicity and racism is at play here, too, in terms of how the West is responding. But following up more precisely on Heidi's question, your organization has also said that based upon Putin's speeches of late, and I quote, "Putin made it clear that he has prepared for an intense and long-term confrontation with the West," close quote. So, Richard, I'm wondering, does this mean that in addition to other manifestations of such a confrontation, there may well also be other countries that Russia invades or threatens in some military way, confronts in some way, in an effort to weaken U.S. and NATO and the challenge you've explained it presents to Russia's own security?
Well, that's extremely hard to speculate on, and I don't really I don't really think that that's what's coming. I think that we see we've seen this incredible reaction, far different than the reaction to the U.S. sponsored and carried out wars in the countries you mentioned, and you know what's going on in Yemen today, where the greatest humanitarian crisis in the world. There's all kinds of crises that are already taking place, and I think that the war that's going on now presently in Ukraine, I think in and of itself has the potential, particularly if other countries step up their some of the NATO powers step up their intervention, to bring about a wider war. That I think that's pretty much certain that can happen. We can't, though, predict that because we don't have a crystal ball. We just have to follow the events as they unfold.
I think, understandably so, as a potential great danger. Thanks, Al.
Well, let me just follow up with that. If smaller nations, in addition to the larger NATO nations, who might promise or are indeed providing military aid to Ukraine, would seem to give Putin a reason to extend his war to those smaller NATO nations, or might he be restrained from doing so, given that NATO and including the U.S. would then likely be required to come to the defense of such smaller NATO nations?
Yeah, I think that has got to be, you know, very much in the thinking of the Russian leadership, that, you know, I mean, everybody knows, I think, by this point, who's paying attention at all, that the if any NATO state is attacked, then they all have to come to the aid of the NATO state that's attacked. The only time that's ever happened in history, as far as I know, had to do with 9/11 and the attacks in the United States, and then the U.S. use that as a way to bring NATO into the Iraq war, into Afghanistan as well, the Afghanistan war. And I think that they're a very, very long way from dealing with the Ukraine war. The Ukraine war, which, you know, we can explain the Ukraine war in the way, you know, I think what led up to it. It doesn't mean that we support it. There's many, many problems that are arising from it, for many countries around the world, as well as, of course, primarily for Ukraine and Russia at this point. But it looks like a very long way before that the Ukraine war comes to an end. I mean, we could be wrong, and there could be developments both inside Ukraine and inside Russia that could shorten the duration of the war. But I think that that's what's on the, you know, that is has to be taking the first place for all those who are involved in the war, in particularly in Russia.
Mm-hmm. And also, Richard Becker, the corporate media, I want to talk about that a little bit, but and aspects of that and some surprises in that regard. The corporate media in America, of course, not surprisingly, is in the main playing the role of, well, the State Department's propaganda bureau where the war in Ukraine is concerned, except for Fox News. I wonder, what has caused, do you think, Fox News and apparently much of its huge American audience, otherwise it probably wouldn't be doing it, along with a significant number of right-wing Republicans, to more or less take Putin's side in the war.
Well, it seems like one of these great ironies of history, doesn't it? I mean, it's so
really
weird.
Yeah.
There's been, on the liberal side, in mainstream politics now, just this complete capitulation to the war makers. And of course, the war makers, and by the war makers, I mean both the people who are in government and the Pentagon, but in the military industrial complex, the military industrial corporations, which are, I think, very happy about the war. I think they feel this is great. They've said so. They've said the crisis is helping them. I think that was the head of Raytheon who specifically made that statement on a call with you know, with shareholders. So you have that taking place, and then those Republican they're also connected to the military industrial complex very much so. And if that is that what's moving them in that direction, or is it that they have see this as an opportunity to unite with the right wing, and it's mainly right wingers in Europe, the extreme right, who are supporting the Russian intervention against Ukraine. Of course, Ukraine has a very sizable forces that are fascists themselves. That are, some have been integrated into the Ukrainian military, and some of them are not integrated into the Ukrainian military. I'm not saying that most of the people in Ukraine or anything like that, but there's been, and so you have like what seem to be very contradictory elements that are going on, you know, on both sides you have these extreme right wing, and I think that there's been this idea that Putin represents, you know, kind of the international right wing for some of the, many of the right wingers in the U.S.
Well, and as an authoritarian figure, a Trumpian sort of figure in the eyes of all too many people in the country, and of course Fox News is always panders and continues to pander to that.
The sanctions placed on Russia are taking a heavy toll on their economy, as intended. But do you believe, as many economists do, that the sanctions will ultimately have a far more devastating impact on the working class men and women of Russia and of the world than on Putin and the Russian oligarchs?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, because the sanctions are very far-reaching and are likely to have many, many effects on many, many countries. One thing we know, Juan Gonzalez, not the one on Democracy Now!, but on the National Security Council, he made statements today, yesterday and today, saying that by design, the sanctions against Russia are meant to inflict more suffering on Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela. So, you know, they're trying to strangle those countries, their economies, with the sanctions. The sanctions, I heard something that, you know, Egypt imports a great deal of its wheat, which is key to its being able to feed the population, from Ukraine, and some from Russia. And, you know, what's going to happen to them? What's going to happen? This is a very complicated issue. The world economy has been very integrated, and Russia has been not a leading power, probably I think it's considered the 10th or 11th economic power in the world, but still, it has, the sanctions on Russia can cause a lot of suffering. We're opposed to the sanctions in general. These kind of sanctions against countries really should be considered a crime against humanity. I've been to a number of countries that have suffered under sanctions regimes, and it's terrible. It's really, really horrible, and it's not explained to people in the United States. It's, you know, so many people think, well, it's better than war. It isn't. It is war. The sanctions on Russia are sufficient to bring about really unforeseeable consequences in the global economy, and have particular effect and impact on poorer countries, and also may really lead to a further surge in inflation. I think that's very possible.
And Richard, you're certainly correct when you talk about these. This is an act of war when you impose these kinds of sanctions, because they are boycotts, and boycotts can be acts of war, as has been declared under international law. So you're quite right about that. You know, Richard, you and I know that the American peace movement has moved into action whenever it has opposed America's imperialistic wars of intervention, such as in Vietnam or Iraq or Afghanistan, Central America, too many places to mention. But in the present situation, where the United States and other imperialist nations are themselves opposing the war Russia is waging in Ukraine, the war of another imperialist nation, I guess, the issue for the American peace movement is not so clear-cut as in the past. So what would do you think, what should be the political positions and demands of the U.S. anti-war movement in response to Russia's war in Ukraine? Or should there, is it possible to build an anti-war movement given this somewhat complex situation as viewed by the American people and as distorted as it is presented by the American media?
Well, it is, it's a difficult time, I think, for the anti-war movement. There's no question about that. I think what we are focusing on, the Answer Coalition, we're participating in various activities that are happening around the country, but we're particularly focusing on explaining what has brought this about. And I think that clarity in that way is especially important, because the mass media here is doing what the mass media always does in times of crisis, is it essentially becomes a multi-pronged state media. And it's more efficient and more effective because it is multi-pronged. So it seems like, wow, they're all saying the same thing. It must be true. So we have to fight against that and explain what has really brought this about, the role of NATO in bringing it about, the role of NATO as an offensive, a warmongering institution headed by Washington and the Pentagon. So I think that that's a critical element. And then, you know, there's many other things that are going on as well. There's many, many webinars that are taking place that people are sponsoring and we are sponsoring in as a way, and the production of literature and so forth as a way to explain what is really happening and to call for no U.S. intervention, an end to the U.S. intervention, and really calling for not only an end to NATO expansion, but an end to NATO, the disbanding of NATO.
Dick, in our few remaining minutes, can you address the issue of the cancellation of treaties, specifically the IMF treaty, and what that means?
Yes, it's a very important question, and one which has been almost entirely ignored by the mass media. And that is that in 1987, I believe it was 1987, when Reagan was president, he signed a treaty with Gorbachev, then the leader of the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was still there. And the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, it was called. And it said that, you know, and it was really, it came about, that treaty came about because of the huge anti-nuke movement in Europe. Because for the countries of Europe, they said, "Oh, we're going to have, you're going to put these short-range missiles or intermediate-range missiles on our soil, and you know, and then when the war comes, we'll be completely obliterated because we're the source of the, of those missiles being fired at the then Soviet Union." So there was a big opposition, huge. Millions of people participated. They signed the treaty. It barred the stationing of those intermediate missiles, which could be nuclear armed, from being, you know, in anywhere in the range of 300 to 600 miles from the from either side, from either side's borders. And so that treaty led to the removal of many missiles that could hit Soviet cities and also Western and Eastern European cities in very short time, like in such a short time that it would almost be once the launch happened, the other side would have to launch. So that's what made it so, so dangerous. So in 2019, the Trump administration, Secretary of State Pompeo and Trump, they canceled the intermediate range nuclear forces treaty unilaterally. Like just they did away with the JCPOA with Iran, the Iran nuclear deal. So that meant that if Ukraine, and there was a renewed, I think, push in 2021 to start the process again that had been going on back in 2014 of trying to really aggressively move Ukraine either in fact or de facto, you know, either de jure or de facto, either by legal means or just by building up the weaponry inside of Ukraine. And that accelerated in the fall of U.S. weaponry and other NATO countries sending weaponry in, but particularly the United States. So if you look at it, if we look at it from the other side, from the Russian side, the treaty is being canceled. This very aggressive move is being made in regard to Ukraine. And if we can't bring Ukraine in at this point because there wasn't unity in the in NATO about it, there was strong opposition from really the two most important powers after the United States, which is Germany and France, to do it, to have the de facto buildup of those weapons. And I think that helped to accelerate this whole crisis. One thing I should say is that, you know, just in regard to what Soviet foreign policy was in regard to NATO, and they always sought and had a motto of not seeing the imperialists unite, and that would be the grave danger. And unfortunately, what it looks like today is, all having said all that we've said, that NATO appears to be more united, at least in a temporary sense, than it has been for a very long time. And you have now have Germany, which was very much opposed to sending weapons. And so, again, we can see what led up to it, the cancellation of the INF, the aggressive move to arm and rearm Ukraine, or arm Ukraine with weapons it never had before. But at the same time, I think that the decision to launch the intervention, the invasion of Ukraine, has led to many, many consequences, including that one, which I don't think any of the past leaders would have wanted to see happen, that past Russian or Soviet leaders, and that is the unity of NATO.
Well, that's a good point, and we thank you for that, Richard. Really, and before we do run out of time, let our listeners know where they can learn more, because that's one reason why we are having you on here today. We here at Law and Disorder want to try to fill that huge gaping hole that the mainstream media presents to us with respect to the full story about the war in Ukraine. So what sources would you suggest our listeners could go to, websites and the like, to learn more about what we've been talking about here today on the show?
Well, I can suggest a couple. One is liberationnews.org, and it's Liberation News, all one long word with two N's in the middle there. Liberationnews.org, and right now on liberationnews.org there are links to the Empire Files program, where Abby Martin interviewed Brian Becker of Answer, and that's gotten over 180,000 views now. And then there's other material there, and you can also go to Breakthrough News, and of course the websites of Pacifica, KPFA, KPFK, WBAI, etc. So I would say those: Liberation News, Breakthrough News, and the Pacifica networks. And there's more, of course, too.
Sure.
Empire Files is a good one.
That is a great one. It's a great one. Richard Becker, really, thanks so much for your work and for joining us today here on Law and Disorder.
Thanks, Heidi. Thanks, Jim.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. We'll be right back.
Is the most widespread form of censorship in the United States. That's when government officials, private individuals, or organizations remove books from libraries, school reading lists, or bookstores because they object to the content or the themes contained therein. Children's books are often the main targets. Complaints are typically that the book is sexually explicit, contains graphic violence, has offensive language, or shows disrespect for parents and family. Censors claim they're afraid the contents are dangerous for kids or that they'll cause young people to raise questions or incite critical inquiry that parents, political groups, or religious organizations deem inappropriate or just aren't ready to address. Before the 1970s, book bans typically focused on obscenity issues. Lady Chatterley's Lover by D.H. Lawrence and Ulysses by James Joyce were often banned. From the late 70s on, attacks focused more on ideologies. To Kill a Mockingbird, The Color Purple, The Catcher in the Rye, and even Harry Potter are among the 50 of the top banned books in this country. A new wave of book banning in public and school libraries is sweeping the nation in 2022. It's been underway since debates have percolated over critical race theory and what students should learn in the classroom. Several states are cutting funding for books written by authors in specific communities. Joining us to talk about book bans and free speech issues generally is Christopher Finan, Executive Director of the National Coalition Against Censorship. Chris previously served as president of the American Booksellers Foundation for Free Expression. That's the bookseller's voice in the fight against censorship. Before that, he was executive director of Media Coalition, a trade association that defends the First Amendment rights of producers and distributors of media. Christopher is the author of From the Palmer Raids to the Patriot Act, a history of the fight for free speech in America by Beacon Press, which won the 2008 Eli Obelder Award of the American Library Association. His forthcoming book is titled How Free Speech Saved Democracy. Christopher, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to start with a rather loaded question, but it will set the tone for our discussion. Chris, how important is freedom from censorship of books and speech to a democracy? And if you will, how dark a time are we facing, given an uptick in the banning of books and other forms of censorship?
Well, it's a really good question, and you know, I think looking at free speech generally, and not just books, you know, to look back at the 19th century as a comparison with what free expression is considered to consist of today, it's, you know, it's like night and day. You know, in the 19th century, when everybody said they believed in free speech because there was a First Amendment, in fact, there was widespread censorship, and the people who took it in the neck the most were people who were fighting for equality. So abolitionists and suffragists and unionists, and they all faced government repression in continuing on into the 20th century and really, you know, through the 30s, although there was progress. But so, you know, in the broad scheme of things, the broad span of American history, we're certainly a heck of a lot better off now than we were then, or even 50 years ago. But it doesn't mean that the threats that exist today aren't serious. I think having been in this business now for 40 years, that I can safely say that we haven't seen this much book banning since the 1980s. And in the 1980s, at the very beginning of what I think in retrospect is a culture war, you know, there were over 1,000 challenges to books in schools and school libraries around the country every year. We managed to get that down in the intervening period to maybe around 300 or 400 challenges a year. And mind you, these are numbers are just based on reports to the American Library Association. You know, the actual number of challenges is probably a multiple of 2 or 3 times that many that just aren't reported. So, but there were 1,000 challenges a year in the early 80s. We're proceeding at a clip right now of about 5 challenges a day, between 5 and 10 challenges a day, according to ALA, which would put us very close to being really, you know, back in the soup that we were in the 1980s. So it's bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wonder, Chris, also, if you talk about speech codes on college campuses. They've been with us for a while, but they are changing too. Do you have any concerns over recent trends where such codes are concerned?
Well, actual legal codes, you know, the kind, there was a period in which a number of universities adopted, you know, formal legal codes. Those were largely held to be unconstitutional. There are still codes, you know, suggested conduct, but they are not the draconian codes that were introduced in the 90s. That said, you know, there's a lot of pressure. A lot of people feel that a lot of people on campus feel that students, particularly, that conservative speakers shouldn't be granted a venue and the legitimacy of speaking at a major institution. And, you know, this is sometimes characterized as cancel culture. So it's certainly something that that we have some concern about. That, you know, we work to try to talk about the importance of free speech to progressive values and to the achievement of greater democracy with young people. It's one of our challenges. But it certainly doesn't compare in any way in terms of to what's going on right now in efforts to suppress books in public schools and libraries.
Speaking of critical race theory and certain curricula and books being banned from the classroom, as you suggested, are these happening on any particular kind of college or university? Some have said it's sort of the more elite institutions. Have you seen a pattern about that? And what do you think accounts for an increase in crackdowns on faculty speech?
Well, I think, I'm not sure. That, I mean, we certainly do hear about things when they happen at elite institutions, but certainly there have been demonstrations at public institutions as well. And so I wouldn't know how to really weigh the differences there. The crackdowns that you're speaking about on what exactly are you referring to? Which kinds of?
We've heard reports of faculty members being reported onto the administration for what some students may call insensitive or offensive speech. And I believe there have been a number, you know, cases in the news that we've read about where either a faculty member has been discharged or punished by the administration in some fashion.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that is a serious problem, and I do believe that universities need to defend freedom of speech, particularly among faculty, and to respect academic freedom. But that is certainly one of the hot topics right now on campuses.
I wonder, too, in terms of book banning, in the broad sense, Chris, what is the current state of the law regarding the role of so-called community standards in fixing the constitutional limits on censorship and book banning?
Well, community standards is a concept that was introduced in the 70s, you know, by a conservative Supreme Court to presumably to make it easier for local communities to apply standards that might not, that might be narrower than metropolitan standards in defining, you know, what is what material is obscene and what isn't. So my organization, the National Coalition Against Censorship, was actually founded in the aftermath of the most recent Supreme Court decision on obscenity, and we were very concerned, you know, that the that this could lead to a great deal of censorship around the country, and there were a number of important court cases that were fought, and it ultimately hasn't had a great deal of impact on obscenity. Where it arises in the current controversy is there are claims by the people who are challenging these books that some of these books are obscene, which is frankly ridiculous. You know, these are books that have been selected by educational professionals because they feel that they address the needs of their students. These are not pornographers who are making these choices for our communities. And it's simply a matter of the greater explicitness of those materials in terms of just addressing issues of sex for kids is what is offending people. It's not that anybody is even claiming that these books are appeal to prurient interest, which is part of the test for obscenity. It's really just a way to pressure, you know, referring these complaints to prosecutors, which has happened on a couple of occasions, is just really an effort to put political pressure on the school boards to act. It's just, frankly, it's impossible to... there is, in fact, a separate standard for minors called harmful to minors, which is a variation of the test for adult obscenity. And as long as it has serious value for minors, it can't be obscene, and it would never be recommended for minors in schools if those educators didn't believe that it had serious value. So we think these are false claims.
I see. Chris, in light of the Supreme Court's ruling in Board of Ed, Island Trees Union Free School District versus PICO, where, of course, the court's opinion was narrow and applied only to removal of books supposedly from school libraries, does this nevertheless leave us in a dangerous situation where book banning is concerned?
PICO, there are only two real Supreme Court decisions that that protect free speech in schools. One is the Tinker decision, which allowed for non-disruptive protest by students that grew out of a protest against the war in the 60s, and the PICO case, as you mentioned. So we have to lean on those two cases. And PICO was decided by a plurality of the court. It wasn't even a majority opinion. So it's kind of a wobbly precedent, but we certainly refer to it. And it held that schools could not decide in the libraries, and this is different from curriculum, they could not exclude books based on their point of view. They could only bar books that were pervasively vulgar. So that's given quite a bit of protection to, at least theoretical protection, to books in school libraries. Curriculum's another matter. The Supreme Court has given school districts greater, you know, local control, greater say over, you know, what the books that are used in classes, in teaching.
Chris, I'm curious, do we see this book banning happening more or less equally
on the high school as well as college levels?
I'd say it's far more pervasive in public schools, you know, K through 12, than it is on college campuses, and this is because, you know, there is because of the age of the kids that are involved, you know, it's just it appears to some people to be a greater threat to young people than it is to eight kids who are 18 and above.
You know, the American Library Association, Chris, its Office for Intellectual Freedom, of course, documents censorship incidents around the country, but it also suggests strategies for dealing with those. What are some of the ways that can be countering to this growing trend?
Well, one of the things that we've depended on the most since the 80s is the adoption of written detailed review policies by school districts. In the old days, before these policies existed, if a parent went in and complained to a principal or complained to a district superintendent about a book, it could just be pulled, and you know, at the discretion of that administrator, and nobody would be the wiser. And that was a real pressure point, a parent or a group of parents could really have a great deal of say over what everybody else's kid could read. So the review policies are generally call for the creation of a committee made up of a teacher or a librarian or some kind of school media person. Sometimes a parent, often a parent, sometimes a kid, and they do the ridiculous thing of reading the whole book before they decide whether or not it should actually be banned or not. And you laugh, but it's like there was this case in Washington of the school board banned a book, and they got so much heat that they decided that they would read the book. They read the book and they said, "Oh, of course, we shouldn't have banned this." But so that's the first important safeguard is that the committee reads the book. The committee then decides, you know, whether it's appropriate at the grade level that it's been graded for. And in an overwhelming majority of these cases, the books go back on the shelves. And to some extent, that's happening now. The fear that we initially had was that that school boards would fold under all the political pressure that's being applied, and many did. And they pulled not just one or two titles; they pulled whole lists of titles that were being circulated by conservative advocacy groups and politicians. And it was anybody's guess whether these books would ever, whether they would review these books as their policies required or not. And what we're seeing now is that thankfully a lot of these books are being returned, but a lot aren't. And so we're still confronted with really a small group of people, of, you know, activists and people who know how to use social media to make decisions about how not only their own kids read, but what other kids can read. And that's always our concern. And our feeling, you know, in all this, and whenever we're hit with the parental rights argument, is absolutely the parent has a right to decide for their own kid what he or she reads. But what they don't have is the right to decide for other people's kids, and that's the distinction that they're just not getting. You know, if it's not right for my kid, it's not right for anybody's kid, and that's where we really get wide-ranging censorship.
That's an important distinction. Thank you for that. Chris, what do you see as the most imperiled aspects of free speech these days? And I'm curious if the internet and social media has made threats more ubiquitous.
I don't think there's any doubt that social media has exposed a lot of things, a lot of hateful speech, and you know, people are rightly concerned about the threats about hate speech and about misinformation and disinformation. And I think it's safe to say that, you know, the lies about vaccines have cost lives. So it is a real danger. And I don't think any free speech advocate would argue that it isn't a problem. The problem with social media, though, is how do you distinguish what is dangerous speech from what is merely provocative speech, and who makes these decisions, and how are these decisions made, and do we want to go back to a world where the government makes these decisions? What are the responsibilities of social media companies? Where, you know, it's a very complicated issue that, you know, we're still trying to work out. So yeah, I certainly share a lot of the concerns of have been expressed about social media, and we work on that to some extent. We have an arts advocacy program. We work with artists, we work with curators and museums, and, you know, trying to get the social media companies to respect their own guidelines for what material stays up and goes down is more than a full-time job. I mean, it's you know, they have algorithms making decisions that are, you know, suppressing a lot of perfectly legitimate material. It is a real conundrum, and you know, it'll take us considerable time to work it out.
Chris, though, before we run out of time, I want to make sure we give you a chance to let us know, when will your new book, How Free Speech Saved Democracy, it's called, be available, and how can our listeners follow you and the wonderful work of you and of your coalition?
Well, thanks. The book is really an effort to introduce people, because I think Americans aren't great history readers, to the role that free speech has played in our history in advancing equality by supporting the groups that I was talking about in the 19th century, and in this century, you know, being a real foundation under the civil rights movement that made it possible for the civil rights movement to survive the repression of state actors in the South. So it's going to come out. It's a short book, intentionally short, and it's meant to be as accessible as possible so that kids can read it as well. And it'll come out on April 26th. It's from Steerforth Press. It can be pre-ordered now. And my friends, the independent booksellers, will be glad to take orders as well.
Just wondered how our listeners can follow what you're doing and follow the coalition's work. Websites or whatever would be best.
Sorry, I was, you know, mostly focused on myself there. Our website is ncac.org, ncac.org, and you will find a plethora of the letters that we are writing now to school boards, trying to get them to maintain their to maintain their responsibilities under these review policies. And we also you can follow us on social media, and we would love for that to happen.
Great.
Yes, it's just been a joy to talk to you today. Congratulations on your forthcoming book. I was lucky enough to read a small part of it. It's superb. Keep up the marvelous work with the coalition. It's timely, and you're doing a great job.
Yeah, and I admire the fact that it is a book that can be read by young people. That's where we have to do a lot of our educational efforts in, of course. It's an accessible book. It's not just a book with, you know, thousands of footnotes and thousands of pages. It can serve a real purpose as an activist for free speech and why that is necessary to save our democracy.
Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you guys today, and maybe we can follow up, you know, down the road.
Yes, sure. We'd love to. We'll stay in touch. Thank you, Chris. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.